エロファン。Right, yesterday you listened to part one. I got a number of people that called and after the program and said, "Hey, don't make me wait and don't make me wait a week to listen to the rest of that there, Bozo." And I said, "Who are you calling Bozo?" And they started laughing. So we'll do that. This, for those of you who didn't hear yesterday, listen to it. But this is a PME that was held in 1989. Marine Corps is in the beginning of a debate about how it fights, how it sees itself, how it makes decisions. We were considered an attrition force, two up, one back, and so General Al Gray, much to his everlasting credit, gets full marks for creating an intellectual enlightenment in the Marine Corps. And this pitch is emblematic of it. It's the best one I've ever heard. It changed the life of me and the professional life of a lot of Marines that have listened to it and have put stock in it and whatnot. So, but there was a huge debate in the Marine Corps at the time. And a lot of it was, I will tell you, in my opinion, was personal. Bill Lind is a academic, never served, historian, Germanophile, and he was going toe to toe intellectually with guys who had fought in Vietnam, some had fought in Vietnam and Korea, and they did not want to hear his bullshit. Who is this guy? And I'll tell you what, and he wasn't afraid to be disrespectful and sarcastic about the Marine Corps. And that really irritated a lot of people. And so, as a result, he didn't get a whole lot of traction until General Gray came and forced the Marine Corps to take a look at a different way of fighting. And I'll tell you what, as somebody who went down that road, there's a few things I would recommend that you read. One is called A Bias for Action, and it looks at the German command and control system and how they operated tactically, what you were responsible doing. Now quite interestingly enough, at the time, our lack of intellectual understanding of what maneuver warfare and the way the Germans practiced it contributed to some of the resistance to it. You know, for instance, this whole idea of initiative, gaps, surfaces and gaps, and if you see the gap, you have to use your initiative, blah, blah, blah. Well, I coined a phrase, and this is a Mike McNamara phrase. Initiative will kill a lot of people, a lot of them your own, unless it's coordinated. So the phrase I used to talk about was the concept of coordinated initiative. If it's important enough for you to deviate from the plan, the second thing you do after you make that decision is you better tell somebody. Because there may be something that you don't know about at your level where you exist that's en route to strike that target, that's going to deal with that. And you're going to either fritter away combat power or you're going to get in the vicinity of it and you might get dead too. So this whole idea of this dynamic, vibrant, reactive force that exploits enemy mistakes is great on paper, but then you lay it down and say, okay, how does this actually work? How does this actually work? So that's what we were going through. And so, I can recall one day from a footnote. This is a funny story. I read a book called Wiedemeyer Reports. Wiedemeyer was one of the few Americans that went to the Kriegsakademie, the infamous German school where they taught Wehrmacht officers the way they operate. And so, German general staff officers were made, blah, 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 blah. at that school. So he came back and he wrote about it. And the other thing he did was he translated the German troop leading manual, the Truppenführung, into English. And in the footnote, it says that it's in the Library of Congress. And lo and behold, guess what? It was. In fact, I have it sitting behind me by about 5 feet in a bookcase. And so I wanted to read, how did this maneuver warfare thing look to a squad leader? And it was interesting. And there's a phrase in there. I'll find the phrase while he's doing this thing, and I'll read it verbatim. But it's the 1934 German troop leading manual. And I'll tell you a little bit about it. But I should scan it. I should scan it and put it on the website. Anyway, I don't think they have a copyright claim, do they? The Third Reich? Do they still have copyright claims? I don't think so. So anyway, but what this one passage says is that, you know, the combat power of the organization is paramount. If you fritter away the combat power of the organization, you do so at the peril of your own existence professionally. So it better be substantial, and you better be coordinating it. Because we don't, so it isn't a skip and go naked event, which many people had said. Oh, you know, free play, blah, 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 this and that. You know, okay, free play has its role in exercises, but free play exists even, let's just say for a platoon. The platoon exists within the context of the company. It's not out there individually doing its thing. And all the decisions have to be made, you know, like that. The company exists in the context of the battalion. And all those decisions have to be made like that. So there was great, first of all, personal animosity between the top exponent of maneuver warfare, at least as it happened in the Marine Corps. And then you had, you know, guys who had never fought, you know, Bill Hinton espousing this. And then you had people that were technicians that said, okay, well, how does this work? How does this work? And so this is what Tony Zinni steps into the middle of. And this is why this thing is so great. He calls bullshit on certain things in a very, very funny way. Does it in public? Does it right to Bill Lynn's face? Yesterday he goofs on the, I think it's finger licking stool. And, you know, he likens it to Kentucky Fried Chicken or something like that. Everybody laughs, but what he does is he disarms a lot of people about looking at these concepts. And it changed the Marine Corps. So anyway, so you're going to hear part two of that today, and along with the question and answer piece that I have to pull together here. So without any further ado, we pick up where we left off yesterday. That is General Anthony Zinni. He's a colonel. He's just left the 9th Marine Regiment in Okinawa. He's working, I think, at McCitic in Quantico, Marine Corps Combat Developmental Command, Combat Development Command, and he comes over at the request of the president of Marine Corps University, Brigadier General Paul Van Riper, and he speaks at the basic school in, I believe, I can't remember the name of the dining facility, at the dining facility that was packed. So, with all of that said, here he is. There's a break going on, okay? So that's what all the ambient noise is.
I had a question or comment at the break regarding combat leadership, regarding somebody working on something, publication or course regarding that. And I did say a couple things I'd like to say about this subject, but I'll tell you my opinion. We got to get rid of the way we teach it now. I mean, you know, somewhere after World War I, we want to make everybody a Boy Scout. Right? There's 14 traits, clean, reverent, obedient. You know, I mean, even the last time anybody walked this earth like that was 2,000 years ago. And we're making everybody believe that there's some magic formula where you go out and you take on these 14 traits and you adopt all these leadership principles and boom, you're magic. On the battlefield, you can do it all. That's not the case. Matter of fact, most great captains rarely had even half those traits. You've got to stop teaching this trait orientation in leadership. That's really not what gets it. There's three basic traits you need, as I described. Well, we got to start making people more decisive, more knowledgeable. We got to focus on what really wins. And it isn't just a series of traits that we need to discuss and talk about, and somebody's supposed to go into a closet and put them on in a little suit that's red, white, and gold, and blue. But it won't work. All right, so we're going to kick off and talk about the series of maybe concepts. One I'd like to talk about, some of these we've beaten to death, but I'll bring them up again and maybe they can generate some discussion here. One is the objective. Remember I told you one of the biggest problems a commander has is figuring out what he wants to do. That's true. I see that all the time. Battalions, and regiments, and divisions, and in myself. Given this situation, what the hell do I want to do? Come to grips with it. I need an objective. I need to figure out what the objective is. Now, in my term, this is the focus of main effort. The objective, what I want to do. The focus of main effort is not one of my battalions. That may be my main effort, but it is not the focus of my main effort. The focus of my main effort is my objective, my aim. I'm glad I used that term because Colonel Boyd did too. So I'm glad it's the aim all the time. I like that. Better than objective.
Now, just I'll interject in here as I did yesterday. John Boyd's sitting in the, he's wearing a pair of gray tan khakis and a white shirt, and he's got a pair of glasses that are down on his nose, and he's taking notes as Zinni's talking, and he's sitting there, and as Zinni, as he said that, you know, you look over at Colonel Boyd, and he's smiling and kind of nodding at Zinni, and Zinni was conscious throughout the whole presentation that Boyd's sitting there, and again, John Boyd, father of the OODA loop, observe, orient, decide, and act, which is was very much being written about at the time. So he is very happy. He used the word aim, and he came to the same conclusion, which is good.
Because objective in our mentality means crusades around physical things, terrain. So it's better to think of what the hell you want to happen, the aim of all your actions. It is 99.9% of the time on the enemy and something you want to do to him. I think, and I was confronted with this in a big discussion at dinner with somebody back here regarding times when it may not be articulated in terms of the enemy. I think there are times that there are other things that might be expressed in your mission that might cause you to have an objective and express it in terms other than the enemy. An example, you're going to land and seize a port airfield. The enemy doesn't immediately threaten it. He will shortly. Your job is to grab it as quickly as possible, make it serviceable, introduce follow-on forces. You boom in there, and you may express this objective where it really is geared to those two physical objects. That port airfield is being grabbed intact in a short period of time. It's being maintained and secured and being rendered operable as soon as possible. So it may not always be expressed in terms of the enemy, but 99.9% of the time, it will. It is definitely not terrain, which is the way we do it now. I'm talking about the mission. Some of the things that I've experienced. The first thing we do regarding the mission is we get a magic mission down at higher headquarters. We analyze it. The first step in analyzing it is determining the task. We now break out the specified tasks, those that are actually written down in there. Boom. The next thing we do is look for hidden, implied tasks. That little sucker, the senior commander, is trying to hide little things on you that you've got to divine, you know. And I'm not going to go up and ask him. I'm going to get together and try to figure it out. What does he really mean by this? Does he really mean that? And we go through this drill. It's amazing. You get a simple mission statement, very much up front. And by the time you're done analyzing it, you've got a string of 48 implied missions that people read into it. Right away, you're beginning to lose focus. I rarely, if ever, go to an applied mission. If I think there's an applied mission, I do an unheard-of thing. I call a guy up and say, is there something I'm missing here? You know, do you want me to do this? I mean, why do I sit there and go through this big drill when you sit around thinking about implied missions? You know, Karnak says. And I don't think it says you need to do that. The system should be designed to do that. The guy ought to tell you what the hell he wants. And if you're not asking, it's important to prioritize tasks. And again, this is something the boss may need to help you out with. But I got to know which tasks are important. I'm trying to achieve focus here. Too many tasks will kill you. You know, and I really think you need to get focused. And even the tasks you get have got to be put in priority. I insist that my tasks and my subordinate tasks and the tasks I get from higher headquarters have to be put in a priority. There is a number one, there is a number two, there is a number three. So it's clear cut. Now, some people line up priorities sort of horizontally. You know, I like to do it vertically. You know, make no doubt about what's important. Commander's intent, you're trying to beat around. I told you commander's intent starts the first day you take command. You have to begin expressing your command, your intent. The problem we have with commanders today is they're seen but not heard. That's the trouble. More commanders have got to get out and teach and talk and expose their thoughts, let themselves be challenged. That's the beginning of intent. You express intent then when you issue the order. You express intent maybe in a mission statement with an in order to statement afterwards that explains why the task is being assigned. You may express it somewhere in the order in anywhere from three short concise words to two paragraphs. I don't give a shit. Whatever it takes, you put it in. You may express it personally to someone, which is the way I like to do it, but you can't always do it that way. You know, you don't always have that option. I got seven motorcycles. I had seven motorcycles in a 93, 2,000 miles on each one, you know, that I put on. So that's 14,000 miles of motorcycle travel, most of it delivering my intent to where I couldn't go first, besides, you know, yellow scenarios, radios, and my presence. I want to tell you an intent story, because I think it's important. Team Spirit, 2 years ago, Colonel Van Riker was the chief of staff. I got to briefly describe the scheme, what we're trying to do. The point of main effort, very mistakenly by the division, was the 4th Marines, but I had to accept that. They were running an attack south, and then they were turning to move towards a link-up with the Army. This is a wide area. I got to tell you, we covered 80 kilometers in 3 days, the 9th Marine, and 4th Marines did the same. I was to protect their flank. As a supporting attack, my job was to clean enemy out, make sure they didn't hit them in this area, and keep them pushed and bottled up to the north, away from the 4th Marines, and definitely away from the link-up site where the Army unit and 4th Marines were converging. In my zone was a series of roads that I think by design of Colonel Van Riper were getting ever thinner and more risky to travel. They went up on the sides of cliffs, where one Moonkai truck coming the other way and one of your five sons with a 1-9 or 8 is going to have a disagreement. And this very thin road network that existed and ran down in sort of this fashion, some of them trailed off. And we had been moving in big bounds and getting behind the enemy. We had a superb aggressive battalion. Matter of fact, Dwight Weber, I see one of yours, gentlemen, 3-8. But I mean, the aggressors were phenomenal. They were smart. I decided at one point, 4th Marines were getting close to the link-up point. The general told me that if I got there quickly, maybe I could do the link-up. So I decided we're going to go for it, 4th Marines, or the 9th Marines. We're going to get into this valley, steep hills all around here. It ran up. So I did a 2-battalion helicopter-borne assault. One came in down in this area, one into the north. I had enemy that was in front of me all in this area. What I wanted to do was get in behind them, cover and seal the link-up point, block any enemy up off to the north, trap this guy in between. Now, I had one problem. My artillery fan was about like this, and my logistics and everything were back here. I stole the helicopters the division brought me, and they took them away from me. I wasn't going to get any more helicopters. They went to the support the range. So I knew I wasn't going to get the kind of helicopter support to talk to logistics. This, my other battalion, I wanted to clear the only road that led me into the valley. Now, I personally go down because I knew this road was going to be an SOB to take. I went down to the battalion commander to give him the mission and my intent. We were playing queen for a day down here. The XO was in charge today. So I go down, and there's the XO. The battalion commander's off doing something else, but he is leading the battalion for this test. So I got him down there, and I said, here's what I want. I want you to clear this road. I'm giving you the entire company of engineers. You're to clear this road in order for me, as rapidly as possible, get the artillery, the logistics, and some of the command and control shit into the valley. And I don't want the battalions hung out here for long. I wasn't too worried, because their size and their force relative to the enemy, it wasn't a problem about getting up there because they were going to get hammered. I said, but I want it as quickly as possible, but I don't want anything on that road. I don't want to run into shit with the artillery battalion moving up, or with some of the command and control, the CSSD, or whatever. You got it? I got it. He then somehow passes that to the battalion commander. Well, the next thing I know, they start clearing the road. They hit the enemy. The enemy's got a series of minefields and obstacles across the road. They go up and provide security. The engineers move up to breach. All of a sudden, the battalion commander decides, I'm leaving the engineers. I'm going to go chase the enemy. And he decides to launch off in this idea that he's going to kill all the enemy and trust them and get them on the run. Dwight Weber, the aggressive battalion commander, very shrewdly peeled off some of the enemy, small units to the north, took the bulk south, stayed in contact with that battalion and moved and drew it off down here. And then his little units from the north fell right back in on top of the obstacle. So I went back to find out what the holdup is. And what I found was an engineer company commander should be put in for the Medal of Honor. Because they were trying to breach this minefield, fight enemies, do all this other stuff. We had a failure to convey the intent. One, from me personally, after detailed explanations to the XO, and then in the passage of the XO onto the CO, there was definitely something lost. Now, the first thing you've got to do when you deal with this sort of thing is establish blame. Now, I do feel I start out by saying it's my communication. It's the responsibility of higher headquarters, therefore it's my fault. Well, and now we got that out of the way. Blame has been fixed. I've accepted it. Now we can talk rationally about this.
That stuff is hilarious when he does it, honestly. And you know what? You want to know what's most funny about it? Is that he's speaking the truth. That, you know, what is this going to do? If I take blame for this tactical event, does it cost me my, you know, publicly, is it going to cost me my career? Am I going to get jammed for it? And so that's why you hear the laughter. But yeah, again, in this delivery, he's peerless, relative to, setting the hook deep, getting people to understand it more, getting people to become intellectually involved in their profession, which a lot of Marine officers did not do at the time. Were not readers. They were executors. They did stuff. But they were not readers as a group. So interesting stuff.
So we got into a big discussion about why this happened. And it was a big misunderstanding. I bring this point up because it's easy to talk about commander's intent, how it clears things up. Human beings hear what they want to hear, or they hear different things. In the map exercises we do, when I give the commander's intent, they're required to stand up, each of them, and then tell me what they understood by the intent, and tell each other, and then how they would execute it. And you'd be surprised at the disconnects in these map exercises. But after you do them over and over again, you'd be surprised at how much now closer together we come. This was a relatively new battalion. He hadn't been through the process. So there's training in giving and understanding the intent. We talked a lot in the last couple of days about establishing and giving intent. No one here has talked about how to receive intent. I don't think I didn't hear it discussed. There's two sides to this thing. The guy that sees it has got to hear it right. And sometimes he doesn't, or he hears it through his own filters, and it isn't exactly the same. So sometimes you got to get the guy to talk back to you and tell you what he heard, to tell you what he thinks he's going to do. That's your little gauge, is to understand maybe how he grasped it. This is not easy. It is not easy to do. It doesn't work very well a lot of times. I picked up a little something I'm going to show you later on. I read something from Rommel that said, when you form combined armed teams, it is sometimes necessary to designate primary elements or a primary element. And I thought about that for a while. And I said, you know, that's a damn good idea. If here I would have given that mission which said the engineer company is the primary element of that combined arms team, BLT-13. That guy could have never missed one thing. That function that the engineer performs is his primary function in that combined arms team. It's the thing he's got to secure, he's got to promote, he's got to protect. That might have been communicated, in that case, by designating a primary element. And I thought that might have helped solve the confusion. He wouldn't have abandoned the engineers back on the road, maybe. But it might help. But you constantly got to look for these ways, I encourage you, to make the intent clear. These little assists to prevent confusion. I want to tell you a little bit about the map exercises we do. I give a situation and a map. They're relatively simple. We got about four or five of them in ninth grade. I had four or five of them in ninth grade. They read the situation. We all come in a big herd. All the officers. They are the regimental commander by the scenario. What they have to do now is do an estimate of the situation. In other words, analyze what's in front of them. And they have to do a concept of operation. Now, when we first get together, we kind of go through now, okay, let's go through the essence. Let's look at the mission, the enemy, the terrain, the fire support, available time, space, logistics, and all this other business. We discuss this. The first shock they get is it was very, very clear to them that their estimate was correct. They saw it correctly. They get pissed because there's a regiment full of officers, and how the hell did you see it differently from me? There are arguments back and forth. When it gets to the enemy, and I'll talk about that in a second, I force them to select a center of gravity. And they very clearly see what the center of gravity is. Some of them do it in companies, some of them do it individually, some do it with their roommate or their buddy, and it was perfectly clear to them the night before. Well, now there's mass confusion after the first session. We never get too far. We come back in for the second session, we usually finish up the essence. Now they've gone back and they've changed their concepts now, because their estimates they get a little uncomfortable with, and they've heard other views and opinions, and they're allowed to go back and change their concepts. Then we get into the concepts. They're all COs and 9th Marines. They all stand up and I take random, you know, this is what I do, this is what I do, this is what I do. At that point in time, I stand up and give my estimate, and I give my concept. And they have action, you know, and they do. I mean, now they're in a froth, and they've had their own opinions, and they're reinforced because there's a couple other little idiots to pack them up. Go right for the jugular. And they come in hard and heavy. And that's the big curveball. And then I do something really terrible at the end of that session. I hand them an order. No more debate. Here's the order. And that's where I kind of held my breath the first couple times. But after I've got their little fur up, and they're all in this ball, what's going to happen now when they're forced to do it my way? There's no problem. They have no problem accepting it. They ain't happy. Not many of them agree with it. In the greatest way, Colonel, you're an old fart. About time for you to leave. It's not the way we do it today. But they take it off. And they go back now, and I break them down by unit. When we come back in, we have a setup somewhat like this. Each of the battalions has a table with the battalion commander and staff and then the companies. I actually take my camp headquarters and I make them another battalion. I don't call them camp. It's not camp, it's staff. It's 4th Battalion, 9th Marine, 49ers. They've got a mission too, and they're organized that way too. And of course, all the attachments come in. Obviously, the engineers and everybody else. And now, each of them must get up and give that they have read the mission, they have read the order, they must stand up in front of everybody and say how they're going to execute it. Well, now, you see how each one read it differently. You see how things are not going to connect. How things, in some cases, are way out of sync. So then you got to talk and discuss how we bring it back in. Why the intent was misunderstood. Why this guy read it one way, and what he's about to execute will not be, excuse me, John Joy, in sync with everybody else. Not in terms of perfect timing, but in terms of the general thrust of what we're trying to do. When we've done that, and everybody's kind of where we should be, the last session we do is what we call operational decision making. It's a little bit like the sand table out here. We bring them in. Okay, it's 6 hour, all hour. We kicked off. But this went wrong, that went wrong. And what I'm looking for from them is decisions like, would they commit to reserves? When, under what conditions? Would they change the main effort? And you try to present dilemmas that force that decision or make it fuzzy as to what they might get into. But I think that's pretty important. I think that begins to get them to understand how I think. Map exercise after map exercise after map exercise. And pretty soon, there's a little book that Vinnie quotes. The thing that did my heart best is one day I saw one of my guys on TV, due by FDN, Far East Network or something, and he had his little mini book, Don't Fall in Love with Your Clan. He was giving all this stuff up in Fuji somewhere, and it made my day. You know, they begin to make fun of you, and they imitate you, and they do all this other stuff. That's good. They know me now. I like that. They know who the hell I am and how I think, which isn't hard to figure out. All right. Talk a little bit about the enemy. I tell my people that every enemy formation, every enemy force, every enemy organization has a center of gravity. Question, sir, do they have more than one center of gravity? Yeah, they may, but don't you worry about that. Pick one. I want focus here. Pick the center of gravity. What is the center of gravity? It's a source of balance. It's a source of strength. It's that one thing that gives that enemy position, that enemy force, its very essence, its being, the thing that can make it a formidable opponent to you, that can prevent you from doing what you want to do to it. What kinds of things are centers of gravity? It may be his will. It may be physically his capital. But let's bring it down, because I told you everything has it. It could be the machine gun on the hill. That's squad on the hill. That goddamn machine gun on the left flank sweeps the front of that hill when he approaches, and we can't quite get to it. We move and we get in there, we smoke it, we hit it, it's dug in, it's under coconut logs, it hits us, I take casualties, it's got to fall back. The damn machine gun nest is the center of gravity. If I can figure a way to do something about that machine gun nest, that guy doesn't stand a prayer against it. You know, it might be a line of operation, a line of support, a line of communication. Now I give them several examples. I start with, I told you, Mike Lottie gave me a great one, Battle of Midway. Where on one hand you got Yamamoto and Nagumo, on the other hand, Nimitz and Spruance, both after the carriers and the lack of focus on the Japanese part. Too many things going on. You know, confusion, not confusion, but distraction and lack of focus on the carriers, singular focus on the part of the U.S. Navy, after the carriers, how that worked. I give them another one, the NBN Poodle. Two similar, again, centers of gravity, the lines of support. One, the French sprung out depending on a very thin air line of support that they overestimated, and of course, the Viet Minh's line of support that the French underestimated, their ability to support logistically supply, loose gear, up in the position. Now, both centers of gravity, how each attacked it, what they did. And it's important for them to understand that. Now, let me tell you how I think they need to understand to go after it, and how I would separate center of gravity from a vulnerability. And how you have to be careful a little bit in the soft spot tactics, surfaces and gaps, and not convey the idea that you attack every vulnerability. But then I think you can just waste energy and expend yourself where you don't need to. This is the way I kind of describe it. This is the center of gravity. You decide what it is, and you decide you want to disrupt it. That's the way you're going to defeat the enemy. Around this thing are a bunch of vulnerabilities. Things that could potentially, or could definitely, or ones that you may not even see right now, lead you into that center of gravity. Now, what you want to do is pick, like a little maze and a little puzzle, the right vulnerabilities to attack that will lead you to the center of gravity. Don't attack the ones that are irrelevant. You waste energy. Now, these kinds of things may be units that are exposed, CTs, logistics sites, like we had on our little board today. They may be things that crush his will or his morale. They may be weapon systems that you destroy. They could be all sorts of things, these vulnerabilities. Some of these are only relevant in terms of time. Some of them in terms of place. Some of them in times of place. Some of them can be a vulnerability, but only at the right time. Now, let me give you an example about timing, because this one I had a hard time. I had a lot of pissed off people about it. Force-on-force operation in Team Spirit last year. 9th Marines against 4th Marines. There were two parts of this force-on-force. The first one, I fought outnumbered. I had 2 maneuver battalions against 4. Learned a lot from that. The second part of this, I had 4 against his 2. I had a lot of fun on that. Now, on the 4-on-2, I got to again briefly describe the situation so they get a little appreciation for this. There was a major crossroad. This was a big battle. The only one really that would support armor and tanks, and it was obviously his line of support, key to him. And he was the defendant. And out into this area was very rugged terrain, all up in here. Roads thinned out. Some very thin marginal roads up in here, some goat trails down through here. Now, I knew he would defend very heavily up in this area, with probably units up into here. I'm unsure what, but I knew heavily at the crossroads. His logistics and other things would be located down in there. What I wanted to do, my intent was to try to get back into here behind him to disrupt his logistics, his command and control, and back into that soft area. If I could turn and get back in there, you know, I really felt that was the center of gravity, the lion's on that line in that main valley. First thing I wanted to do was fix this unit. I ran an attack with the Armored Assault Battalion up here. A Heliborn assault with another infantry battalion that supported the attack and began infiltrating down onto the line in a very shallow area. That attack was launched. I didn't know what was out here. I was afraid he might try to come out and attack me. I don't know how far he was thinned out and what direction. I used the LAI battalion initially in a feint. They ran up, showed themselves here to make me think we might be trying something very shallow or narrow in here, and then they raced around to sweep our left flank and to come up and to come into here to check this. Eventually, LAI was to be my main effort. I was going to spring them for the attack in the rear. What I wanted was a fight today in here, which I knew I could win with the two battalions and the combat power on that, but it would be long drawn after they were dug in. I infiltrated one battalion at night for a fight the next day down through some very rugged terrain. And what I wanted to do through the course of the night is cut some bridges to recon forward and infiltrate behind the lines to figure out what was up in here. I wanted LAI to find out how far out they were, compress them and engage them a little bit, shoot them up, not become decisively engaged. The next morning, this battalion would attack here. I would fix his units along the line. LAI would be sprung for the attack up into his rear. Now, while this fight was going on, but before this one had really become engaged, the units of 1-5 were beginning to filter down at night, I got a report from a recon team I had up here that they saw the 4th Marine Sea Kitchen. And the recon officer came running into me, bubbling at the mouth, and said, "I got 4th Marine Sea Kitchen. We see it. We're working up a fire mission. Stop the fire mission. Don't shoot the mission." He couldn't believe it. You know, the colonels were all alike. You don't want to make yourself look bad, you know. I said, "No, we don't want to shoot up 4th Marine CP right now. First of all, make absolutely sure I got the regimental CP." And they did. And it was the regimental CP, no doubt. And I told everybody, "We are not going to shoot it now." They didn't understand it. It's a vulnerability. It's there. Shoot it. You got it. Shoot it. Why shoot it now? Wait until we attack here. I want to engage the CP at the same time when this is crumbling down on them. This is suddenly attacked, and I've sprung LAI. The timing of that vulnerability relative to the center of gravity of my intent was important. If I shot him up then, what could happen? What are the options? He's got another half of command group somewhere else that takes over eventually. Division comes down and reconstitutes the 4th Marines with something else. But 12 hours later, when this attack takes place, somebody else will be in there supplanting the command and control facility that I've destroyed, I'm sure. The timing was wrong. It was a vulnerability. It was not that time as relevant a vulnerability as it could be based on my intent and what I wanted to do. You know? So that's the kind of thing you want to do. A little later on, we're going to talk about tempo, and I want to talk about this a little bit more.
Imagine sitting in that PME and listening to him and him pulling back a curtain on a style of warfare that you don't know about. You know, you've read a couple articles about it, but, you know, here you have him with all his Vietnam experience, and you're hearing commander's intent, you're hearing main effort, you're hearing vulnerabilities, you're hearing critical vulnerabilities. This is the world that you're going to go to if you want to be part of a serious warfighting organization. How does this work? And sitting there, you know, essentially saying, "Holy shit, man, I've got some reading to do, I guess. And how do I close the gap between me and guys like him, so that I can even have a conversation with him?" Because he continues to spin me with all the different ways he uses this command philosophy that I don't know anything about. Okay, I was a lieutenant in 1984 when I got to the fleet. with 1st Battalion, 5th Marines. All right. And we did our, we did our stuff, essentially two up and one back all over the place. I went from there to C duty, and there from C duty to the basic school. My C duty tour was 2 years. And so they said, nah, it's too quick. You shouldn't go back to the fleet yet. You're just a junior captain. So I went to the basic school and then went to the fleet as a senior captain. And it was life changing event. But sitting there that night, all the different things he's talking about, thinking, holy smokes, man, I don't know about that. What do I do? And then you had Kelly. Read. Well, sir, where do I get this book? I got it. You can borrow it.
These series of vulnerabilities, then, lead you to the center of gravity. You aren't going to see all these vulnerabilities right away. Some of them are going to have to be discovered. They're going to pop out to you. And when you see them, and when they're reported to you, somebody reports the gap, all right? In other words, they report the vulnerability. You have to assess the value of the gap and how much energy to throw into the gap. Is the gap relevant to my intent objective? If it is, how should I take it on, what should I expend, or how much energy should I spend against it? Because I'm going to talk to you a little bit more when we get to tempo about conservation and expenditure of energy, which is key. And I'll bring it back to Vietnam, where I think that's one of the things we miss big time. And it's exceptionally relevant to tempo and how we run it. I had a lieutenant ask me one time, hey, Colonel, when you look at the enemy, what are you looking for? What are the kinds of things you want to know about the enemy or that you want to have a good feel for? And I gave him a little gross to this thing, just off the top of my head, and it turned up into a slide that's always been in here. I like to know what he operates out of.
All right, hold on. We're going to take a break. You're listening to part two of Combat Concepts. At the time, Colonel Tony Zinni, with some of my comments to kind of give you a sense of what it was like to be there, what you felt as somebody who wasn't savvy to any of this, as the Marine Corps went down the road towards embracing maneuver warfare. We'll continue that coming up next right here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military, for a first responder, for a hunter, for an outdoorsman, or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out. Battlemug.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global South Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the South community should be aware of.
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsouthfoundation.org/Marines.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All I can say about MilitaryByOwner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. On a Wednesday, part two of General Zinni's pitch in 1989. I'll read you an email. Mac, it's amazing when you think about in the historical context of the development of maneuver warfare as it was brought to the masses in the Marine Corps. What a great ambassador Colonel Zinni was. I'm a little bit younger than you, but I remember meeting Bill Lind and thinking, what a goofball. And so one of the ways people argued against maneuver warfare was the personal attacks on him and what does he know and he's never fought. But when you hear Zinni talking about these things, the way he uses his humor and then the way he begins to introduce you to a style of fighting that allowed the Germans to conquer most of Western and Eastern Europe. You can't dispute the success of that system. Ultimately, they failed strategically, but I don't believe that was the fault of the German military. They had issues at echelons above them. It is interesting, though, to hear him and to think about that. Love listening to this. Let me tell you, if you want to watch the video is on the website. I just never had done this. And one of the things that somebody encouraged me to do was, hey, you should do it because you were there that night and you should explain, you know, where the Marine Corps was. Like most guys, and I'm emblematic of that. I'd never heard this stuff. If you happened to be in 8th Marines and got to meet, you know, Ray Smith or were in 9th Marines, and cross paths with Tony Sinney. Yeah, but the rest of the Marine Corps was not doing this. Was not doing this. So that's why it's so interesting. So, all right, so we'll continue.
Of operations, you know, where his foundations are for his support, reinforcement, where he would withdraw to, that sort of thing. What kinds of lines he has to him, lines of support, communication, how he's set up. How's he deployed in front of him? You know, what are his formations, positions, where is he, how is he? Remember I told you about the VC and those series of interconnected Vs that became X's and all those things? You know, I was no dummy when I was a lieutenant captain. When I hit that first position in my life in Vietnam, I went through that thing after the fight over and over again, trying to get a picture in my head of how this sucker was laid out. Because if I was going to see it again, I wanted to have a feel for this thing, bigger than a Craig box, you know, smaller than an elephant, what's it like, got edges, you know. What do I got in front of it? His command and control, how does it work? I think our command and control system will always be a vulnerability. Ours is terrible. It's communication dependent. It's complex. You know, after every exercise, we bitch and moan about it. It never works. We advertise the greatest thing since sliced bread. Well, let me tell you, it's not. If you follow the system as the way it is put down on paper, it'll never work. You're trying to do something, and that doesn't. You know, we create our own friction. And not without any enemy friction thrown in, the sucker can't work. I think our command and control system needs to be hardened, streamlined, you know, look hard at it. It's got a lot of problems with it. I'll talk a little about command and control to a minute. I like to know how he collects intel. First of all, this helps me decide on my security measures I take, also how to deceive him, how I can feed him what I want him to believe. I had a little heartburn with some of the deception discussion today. I got the impression, listening to the sand table thing, we were telling every lieutenant to run his own deception program. You know, you can't do that. It's got to be one storyline, guys. You know, I was thinking when that was being described, and you were telling lieutenants about deception and all this other stuff, if that had happened off the list, the guy who wasn't under the mist down in the woods might have said, I'd like the guy to believe that I'm in the mist. Now, that would have really screwed up Napoleon's plan if one of those little gomers that was outside the mist decided to convince the guy in front of him that he was in the mist. I mean, it kind of wouldn't go along with Napoleon's plan. You got to have one storyline. You know, deception, every little squad leader doesn't do his own deception. Or you will, again, get inside your own oodaloo, you know, and unravel yourself in a heartbeat. So, you know, deception is a nice word. We all want to have some. Wherever we draw it, Italian supply or whatever, and however we apply it, we're going to get ourselves in trouble.
You know, that's it. And so those are the kind of questions that, you know, and learning that was taking place, right? Okay, they use deception as a weapon, you know, Sun Tzu and all the rest of this shit, right? And so then you actually, so how does that work? So, you're in a hot wash, a critique, an AAR, whatever you choose to call it, after a problem. And then you have a guy with more experience, a guy like Zinni. And said, and who's sitting in there, and then at the end of it says, you know, first of all, this is awesome. Okay, let me answer your question. And you're like, okay. And the platoon ran its own deception. What was the company's deception plan? Huh? So it's just, it's always one of the things that you see with guys that are broader and deeper is just always linking it to the combat power of the larger units and making sure that you're in sync with what they're doing, which is his point. But, you know, so you hear these things and you don't know, you know, shit about them, and you began to do this. But we had never discussed that kind of stuff, you know? I came through the Marine Corps, IOC, we tied knots. We didn't study decision making. We didn't, you know, and I had somebody tell me, hey, look, Lieutenant, when I want you to think, I'll unbutton my zipper, okay? You'll know it. Yes, sir. You know? And so you were, you know, again, you were supposed to be the master of that platoon, and when they put it in motion, you did what you got told. You know, and they didn't want you to do any more thinking. You know, you weren't qualified. You were a lieutenant. Yes, sir. Boom. On it. So that was the Marine Corps. So these discussions all were full of lessons. And I was really fortunate to be at the basic school then because we had a ton of smart guys there. And we used to argue about this shit. Oh, my God. We'd be teaching classes on it. Well, what about this? That's bullshit. What? Yeah, that's bullshit. And you would, you know, you hear all of that. So just extremely, extremely interesting as you had novices attempting to come to grips with maneuver warfare as the Germans practice it, move it to a culture like the Marine Corps, lay it down, and then learn the nuances of that execution. All right. More Zinni now.
So deception has to be done with the storyline from the highest levels very carefully orchestrated, or else it becomes ridiculous. You're going to have a laughing enemy at the other end. I like to understand his style of operation, how he operates. I go back to Vietnam again. I really, really had tried to understand the VC. I wish I could tell you, oh, I mastered, I understood their tactics, how they fought, whatever. I did not. I talked to a lot of VC NVA prisoners. I spoke a little bit of Vietnamese, but they sent me to school down at Fort Bragg. And, of course, I had my little buddies there who could speak to them. And I really tried to figure them out. I can tell you another thing, because Mike Lowdy brought this back to me in something he said about your frame of reference. The best times I ever had in Vietnam, if I had to ring up the times I did something okay to good, something strange happened. When I was at my best as a company commander or even as an advisor, I began to realize I had a picture in my mind of the enemy commander. I don't know why it popped into my mind, but I had this picture of this other captain over there, a little khaki uniform, you know, with little chopsticks and shit, but I had this vision of this guy. And I was hearing him think, and I was considering what he was doing. When I didn't have that vision, when it automatically popped my mind, I was confused and mixed up. But when I always got that vision, that sort of view of things from the enemy side, I was always better. I felt it seemed that way. It seemed to turn out that way, that view. Understanding him is key. I know guys who went to Vietnam and spent 6.5 years there, one case. And he didn't have a clue about the Vietnamese. He totally did not understand their culture, their people, the purpose, what we're doing there, the enemy, or anything else. But he was there for 6.5 years. You know? So understanding who the hell you're fighting is important. Now, I've berated terrain and put it down a lot. Now I'm going to say a few things that will seem to contradict. I teach a class on terrain appreciation in my office. It's a long class. I got a little book when I was in basic school called the MCS Publication, the old Marine Corps Schools. One of the finest publications I ever read on terrain appreciation.
I went out and found that publication. You had to dig to find it. And it was, the book he got at the basic school, which is, you know, basic study of geography and terrain.
It taught me map preparation. It taught me how to do go, no-go maps. It taught me how to streamline, ridgeline, to highlight the lines of communication, all sorts of things like that. And I spend a lot of time preparing my maps. I go over my maps in a lot of detail. I try to get a mental picture of the terrain from that little glossy laminated map sheet. And when I go out there and the picture isn't what I thought it would be, I get pissed at myself and I go back to my map to try to figure out why I could make that association. You have to spend a lot of time on terrain. You just can't fall prisoner to making terrain the end unto itself. Lines become important. I told you, I mentioned a little bit about the VC. I talked to one. I think it was the North Vietnamese lieutenant one time. He said, well, we could never find these tops. What we did is, you know, we went to all the hilltops. You know, we H&I'd them every night. We did helicopter assaults. And we patrolled all the valleys. You know, we ambushed all the trails and rivers. These suckers, we could never find them. What he said they did is they used to pick a contour line, imaginary one. And let's say this is the hill. They pick a line. They knew the crazy Americans put LZs and H&I to sit out on the high ground, and they knew they walked around a low ground. So they picked a level and walked that level.
H&I, harassing and interdiction fires. You don't know if somebody's there, but you think they might be there, so you blow the shit out of it, right? That's H&I fire. And so he draws this kind of terrain feature, and he puts an X on the top, and that he's... You're gonna H&I the shit out of the top of the mountain, and then you're gonna ambush a patrol down in the low ground. And he said about midway up the hill is what he's talking about now. He said they told me that's where they would find space.
So from above, what you might see is a path that might lead them. It was long. It wasn't as tiring because they didn't go up and down as we tended to do, but they tended to operate somewhere in the middle. You know, they could adapt if we tried to find that, but they tended to move on to a plane different than ours. Trying to determine where lines of operation, lines of support are, what the natural flow is in an area becomes important. Terrain is only important relative to the enemy division, and you've got to make that assessment. It is not an objective. The first thing I would do is never teach terrain objectives in Quantico. Now, there is a dramatic, radical departure from what we would do. Get rid of the two-day student. Never designate terrain as an objective. Try that. I'm going to tell you something else a little later on. It'll maybe surprise, but make that the first surprise. 2 years we ran it that way. People had trouble with it. General Van Riper sent the three out with wire, was it, down to see me. We had a lot of trouble with that. But we never sent overlays up, and we never designated terrain or anything up. They got a blank piece of acetate, 9 3 feet through. So he came down and said, you have to have terrain for focus. You have to. I gave this pitch over at Command of Staff College last year, and the Israeli jumped up and was going to kill me, you know. You can't do that. Junior officers have to have terrain. They need it. It's a crutch. My officer better be better than needing crutches, you know. Draws their focus off where it doesn't need to be. Our own forces, troops and fire support.
You know, think about that, you know, in the context that he's preaching it. You know, no terrain objective. And that's, again, that's how we used to do it. What I got raised on, you know, Charlie Company 1-5, you're going to LD here. And the first hill you see is Company Objective Alpha. Somebody's going to go to that, and you're going to process terrain. Now, think about that. What he's talking about is none of that's going to go exist. You're going to go looking for the enemy. Meeting engagement, movement, contact, get good at it, get good at supporting arms, blah, 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 blah. So it's a really different mindset in terms of when I go out there, I'm expecting to find this guy on one of these hills. And Zinni's point from Vietnam was he's not going to be there. He's not going to be where you expect him to be. You want to know why? Because he can't be there. Because we blow his ass away. But that's how we teach it, which goes back to World War II.
Well, our own forces. The most tricky part of this art of commandership in combat is generating combat power. It manifests itself in how you organize the combat. In my mind, that's the thing that fascinates me more than any other decision I make. I think the idea of a center of gravity is the one key, number one concept you have to grasp to understand all this. The one key, most important skill a commander must have is the ability to generate and create combat power. It's an art. You know, it is how you organize that force, how you mix the right blend of arms, how you task it and move it and everything else is the very essence of commandership in combat. You know, that's the thing you need to learn to master. We don't understand it. One platoon engineers for you, one platoon engineers for you, one platoon for you. One lad section for you, one for you, one for you. You know, that's the way it goes. And do they ever change through the course? Do we ever transition combat power? No.
Think about that, though. Think about what a revolutionary idea when you came from that Marine Corps where, you know, so, you know, you split your machine gun sections, right? You got a machine gun squad with first platoon, second platoon, third platoon, right? As opposed to the whole machine gun sections going with first platoon. What? Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, it's just really interesting. And you're sitting there thinking like, holy shit, like, well, what about me? What does that mean for me? It means you're not the main effort. It means you need to be careful, right? And you need to understand the plan. And you need to be plugged into it. So to me, it's, you know, it was such a different way of operating, you know, from what I knew.
I got to tell you something. One thing I'm pissed about is I'm like everybody else. I'm getting tired of hearing about Germans. I wasn't pissed before. I mean, my grandfather probably was fighting with him. You know, he was one of the guys that didn't read the 1938 Italian version. I got to read that, the Italian version of maneuver warfare film. But, you know, I went to Iwo Jima, the island, about 8 times when I was out there. What a fascinating place. If you guys have ever been there, I mean, I've taken a ton of sand off that place to, you know, increase my household weight allowance by about 50,000 pounds. I went to the spot where the Noble John Bassman was killed and dug a hole and brought it back with me. You know, I became fascinated by that battle because of the island being untouched. General Van Riper and I, we crawled through the caves, you know, all the things that are still there. And just the sheer the amount of violence and shock and the things that went on there are just staggering the imagination. There was a Marine there that practiced maneuver warfare. In the midst of probably the greatest attrition battle in our history as a Corps, there was a maneuverist on that island. It was General Graves B. Erskine. And I want you to read about the 3rd Marine Division in the Senate. And I want you to read about that general and what he did in his decision. It was the essence of maneuver warfare. And you want to talk about not getting hung up with a lot of mobility and distance. We're talking about movements of, you know, 10, 20 yards, a form of maneuver done in that kind of post. Let me tell you some of the things Erskine did. Number one in relation to this, he was continually shifting organizations. He put all 26 of his tanks to one battalion on one side. Then he spread them out and divide them up evenly. Then he pack them up together and move them again. He took the mortars all out of battalions and regiments and gave them all to one regiment. All mortars. You imagine that somebody come down and says, all your mortars are gone. 9-3s are all going over here. You know, and he was continuously screwing with the organization and shifting. He was the only guy that made ground. He fished his cage with Rocky, but those suckers couldn't keep up. He was going to shoot one of them one time. You know, I got the oral history, Graves B. Erskine's oral history, and it's tremendous to read about. He didn't give a shit about the boundaries. I'm going to talk about that. He kept calling up cages and saying, I'm taking that hill, it's in your zone. And of course, the 4th Division commander was just reacting to all this. Yeah, you got it. Change the boundary. He wasn't worried about it. Sent 9th Marines off to take one of the hills in his home. He wasn't worried about where boundaries were. I'm going to talk about control measures in a second. He also was imaginative. He would create scenes. He'd create maneuvers. What he would do is he'd run an attack with maybe 2 battalions. One battalion would make progress. One would be a little held up. He'd run another one through the gap. He was doing these little turning movements and developments all over. When you follow the flow of the battle in any of these history books, you go crazy trying to follow 3rd Division because these little battalion things pop up all over the place. He draws Colonel Kenyon in, steal the 9th Marines, one of my predecessors, and about the middle of the fight, he says, hey, Kenyon, we're going to do a night attack. What do you think of that? Kenyon goes, you're going to kid me. Yeah, a night attack? Yeah. But he says, not yet. It's only one time it's going to work. We're going to pick the right time to do the night attack. The night attack is going to be the coup de grace. And he did. He's one of the battalions in 9th Marines. When he had to break the last ridge line, the last pocket, he did the night attack. The poor guy who went and did it missed the objective. He attacked the wrong hill. Woke up the next morning. The morning dawned, and he said, holy shit, I'm on the wrong hill. The Japanese were so surprised that they hadn't ever seen a night attack that he just moved to the next with a real hill. No problem. And that completely broke all the resistance in his area. Made it to the far side of Iwo Jima, and then got told to clear the 5th Division zone, too, because they couldn't take it. His response was to the division commander, how are you going to do it? He says, you got to do it. I'm ordering you to do it. He said, well, there's none of these cooperative exercises. That bastard senior man, I don't like it. You give me the zone. So I gave him the zone. He says, if you got about 4 days to do this, take your whole division up. He says, I'll do it in half a day with one regiment. So he called the regimental commander and said, you're going to do it half a day with one regiment. He got a shot. He did it with about 17 casualties. Cleaned up the last resistance up there towards Bloody Ford. But read about Erskine, the very essence of maneuver warfare. Not in tax-like 29 Tom's, you know, Russian steps maneuvers. Read about the 1st Marine Brigade in Korea. I think that the essence of maneuver warfare is there. And fighting the MAGCAP is there. You know, we need to look back in the kinds of missions we will most likely get, and it's our own heritage to see those few officers that we had that did in fact practice this art. I think that a couple points I would make regarding mobility. There's such a thing as I call a mobility continuum. Let me tell you what would happen as I saw at basic school, or not basic school, command staff college, and I see a lot of times in exercise. We're going to do a helicopter-borne operation. The scheme is great. Put it in the context of an amphibious operation. Bad guys are lined up over here somewhere, and we're going to make this landing, come in, do some magnificent movement. But what we want to do is launch this helicopter-borne force a little early, get him astride this guy's lines of communication, and this is going to be the thing that really screws him up. A helicopter-borne force in his rear. Now, I've seen this 1,000 times in all these little games. The helicopter-borne force launches at zero dark 30. Put, 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 you know, boom, pops in. Everybody gets out. Shanks Mayer, in your mind's eye, a pack, a helmet, a cartridge belt, you know, one DOA. Could be dead on arrival, you know, but he's got all the other shit on him. We put in artillery spinning off the bottom of a helicopter, split trails, no prime movers, dump a battery in with the guys, you know, none more of that imaginative organization for combat. You know, probably give them, make it an LVSA, to give the flow in, some logistics shit and everything else, put a CSSD in there, plop it down. Well, now, the little bad guys say, great, cannon fodder. Now, boom, boom, all of a sudden they start shooting at it. Now the reports come back. If it's Quila Ursa or whatever exercise he's doing, this guy's getting ready for his big landing, his main effort. Hey, 1st Battalion, 2nd Marines just took 12 killed, 24 wounded. Two artillery pieces destroyed. Oh, shit. Next report comes in. 10 killed, 15 wounded. You know, they just lost another artillery piece. Now, all of a sudden, this masterful stroke, high mobility to his rear, now becomes fatal. Now, everything directly focuses on the thing of most concern. These four bastards are getting annihilated back there. Two decisions. One of two you can make. Reinforce failure. Let's commit the reserves into this goddamn mess. Or let's pull them out, which means send in these empty helicopters like that Gomer isn't going to know you're not going to come and try to get him out, back into the same goddamn zone to extract all these guys under fire, right? What have we done? Mobility ended as soon as you stepped on the ground. It sounds crazy. I like a very light helicopter-borne force with dune buggies and motorcycles and light jeeps and vehicles with pre-served weapons on them, so when the thing goes ramped down, they boom off. You know, light infantry that booms out into the boonies, that is wearing like shit, that when the stuff hits, he's all over back there. He isn't plopped in one place. But we plop. Our helicopter-borne operations are plop operations everywhere we go. Traverse of all the shit we take in with. And you watch, the next time you see one with a reinforced battalion landing, tell me it isn't so. The key vulnerable time is when you transition these organizations to combat from, you know, shifting tanks or shifting armor or shifting missions, and you got to watch those. Those are very vulnerable periods for you. How you transition organizations for combat has to be done very carefully, and that senior commander needs to pay a lot of attention to that. I had a lieutenant ask me one time, hey, Colonel, when you look at the enemy, what are you looking for?
All right, we've got to take another break. We'll come back. I've got to re-cue this, so you'll have to bear with me for about 60 seconds, and we'll continue. Tony Zinni, Combat Concepts, 1989, History of Maneuver Warfare on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner, proven and dependable.
I'm an individual member. I joined the Global South Foundation because I believe in what it can do, and I also wanted to stay tied to the community that I was part of.
The benefits for individual members of the Global Stock Foundation are two things. One is networking, keeping in touch with the community, developing new relationships at any stage of your career. And secondly, it helps people stay abreast and up to date on the latest issues that the stock community should be aware of.
The Global Stock Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalstockfoundation.org/Marines. You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Where the sidewalk ends and the road begins, we said goodbye on a cold, dark night. I'm not afraid to go. You bet I'm not.
I could cover this song and make some money. Okay, bear with me. I got to find a place here in this PME. So it's part two, and it should be about a half hour into part two. So stand by while I flail.
The All Warrior Radio Network.
Yeah. Alright, so hopefully right here.
Ours is thorough. It's communication dependent, it's complex. You know, after every exercise, you bitch and moan about it. It never works. We advertise it as the greatest thing since sliced bread. Well, let me tell you. It's not, if you follow the system as the way it is put down on paper, it'll never work. You're trying to do something, and that's along the line, LAI would be sprung for the attack.
Heard that.
Boundaries work. I want to talk about control measures in a second. He also was imaginative. He would create scenes. He created starting mobility. There's such a thing as I call a mobility continuum. Let me tell you what to his rear now becomes base. Be there in some form, or you need to affect that place in time and some.
You don't just deliver it as a fact afterwards. Support this. You know, it's a cooperative thing. Now, the commander pulls his logistics at the right opportunity. Logistics and sustainment have to be thought of in a tactical context. The when and the where and the how, you know, and where it fits in the flow of time and space and everything else has to be blended into the tactical thinking and scheme. If you separate it and make it an administrative thing, you're going to die, and your timing's going to be terrible. It's not going to be coordinated. You need to understand that. I want to say something for 3rd FSSG and General Mulqueen. They understood maneuver warfare. They organized and they provided the logistics to meet a maneuver battlefield at great cost to themselves. But I'll tell you what, I wish the other components of the MagCAF understood.
Hold on. I don't want to skip anything. So the last thing he talked about was the Heliborne Force, helicopter plop operations, all right?
Be there in some form, or you need to affect that place and time in some way. Threaten it, interdict it, suppress it, goddamn zone, to extract all these guys under fire.
All right?
What have we done? Mobility ended as soon as you...
All right, this is where we kind of left off, a little bit forward to this, but... You'll hear this one more time, and you'll be better. You'll be a better human being for it. So,
on the ground. It sounds crazy. I like a very light helicopter-borne force with dune buggies and motorcycles and light jeeps and vehicles with pre-served weapons on them. So when the thing goes ramp down, they boom off. You know, light infantry that booms out into the boonies, that is wearing light shit, that when the stuff hits, he's all over back there. He isn't plopped in one place, but we plop. Our helicopter-borne operations are plop operations everywhere we go. By virtue of all the shit we take in with. And you watch the next time you see one with a reinforced battalion landing. Tell me it isn't so. The key vulnerable time is when you transition these organizations to combat from, you know, shifting tanks or shifting armor or shifting missions, and you got to watch those. Those are very vulnerable periods for you. How you transition organizations for combat has to be done very carefully, and that senior commander needs to pay a lot of attention to that. Talk a little bit about time and space. I think that it's very important to understand this idea that there are key points and places in time that you need to affect. You either need to be there in some form, or you need to affect that place and time in some way. Threaten it, interdict it, suppress it, occupy it, whatever. But you sort of got to figure out and find, again, I think it goes back to that finger licking, exactly where that place is and exactly when that time is that you need to do something with it. Sometimes you can't see it early on. It's sort of got to be a clearing picture to you, and you kind of know when, and you get yourself in position to affect it. But that key idea of time and space and putting them together and figuring out what's most important. I can get astride his lines of communications right now. I can kill his suited up a CP right now. Is it the best time? Sometimes you know where things are in terms of time when you want to affect it. I would like to hit his reserve just when we do the landing. So I got a good idea of the time factor here that I want to affect. But I got a problem. I don't know where his reserve is right now, 2 days before the landing. So the place is unclear. But the time is pretty clear in my own mind when I want to do it. Maybe you will know the place. That line of communication is what I want to get astride. But I'm not sure when just yet. I just haven't sensed that now is the time when I'll do the most damage. If I go for it now, it's a little too deep, a bridge too far. I will extend myself, I can't support it, and right now it doesn't threaten him a whole hell of a lot. It doesn't really do anything to support my intent. So time and place are important and have to be put together. The idea of concentration and dispersion, mass and economy of force. You know, you're always compressing and expanding all over the battlefield. And you're doing this in those two mediums of time and space. For all the logisticians out here, I got one bitch about something I heard. I was waiting and waiting for one logistician to stand up and say something about it. None of you guys did. You disappointed me. I've heard at least 5 times in the last 2 weeks that you develop the plan, then you turn to your four and say, support it, or can you support it? You've got to talk to your logistician like you talk to your three. He's in on it. He's in on your planning and on your scheme development. You collapse a little sucker, you see? Because if he's in on the development, his heart's in it. And he understands it. You don't just deliver it as a fact afterwards. Support this thing.
What thing?
You know? How was? What is it? The logistician has to be involved in planning. When I go forward to my battalions, I take my four, not my three. When I go to visit battalions, I take the four. What's the three going to do for the goddamn battalion? Four can do a whole hell of a lot. Check him out. How's your temperature, you know? You got shower, water, everything going okay? I want the four. Same as my obligation. I want to do these things. Now, I mentioned something up here called logistics of opportunity. I don't like this idea, this phrase, and I know what it means, and I agree with the meaning, but I don't like the term command push in logistics. You know what? I got an uneasy feeling that in the middle of some operation, I'm going to turn around, as it happened to me, and the refuelers and all the shit are coming down the road with their lights on in the middle of my night attack. It's your turn. It's your time. We push the shit up here. Take it now, Colonel, or screw off, you know? I don't buy logistics that way. You know, and I don't refuel, rearm, and do this shit to the force as a whole. Now, John Boyd and I have long talked about culminating points. I like to think of culminating points in terms of sustainment. There are certain measurable things that you can determine culminating points on. I want to get my users fuel. I mean, here's an example. I know if this guy's got so much fuel that in so much driving around, dicking around, everything else, he's going to go bingo. You know, I'm looking at a culminating point. I don't want that culminating point to happen in the middle of an event that I want this guy to take part in. I look for the opportunity to provide sustainment. I go down and measure the condition of my subordinate units. And you look for that right time to pull them offline or to bring the logistics up. I would like to say it's logistics pull by me. It's not command push me up onto the guy. You know, it's a cooperative thing. Now, the commander pulls his logistics at the right opportunity. Logistics and sustainment have to be thought of in a tactical context. The when and the where and the how, you know, and where it fits in the flow of time and space and everything else has to be blended into the tactical thinking and scheme. If you separate it and make it an administrative thing, you're going to die, and your timing is going to be terrible. It's not going to be coordinated. You need to understand that. I want to say something for 3rd FSSG and General Mulqueen. They understood maneuver warfare. They organized and they provided the logistics to meet a maneuver battlefield at great cost to themselves. But I'll tell you what, I wish the other components of the MAGTF could have understood it like the FSSG did out there. I did more of this discussion with the FSSG officers than I did with the officers, any other officers of the division, the wing, or anybody else, or any of the command elements. There was more of this kind of interchange with those logistics officers in that group than any place else. And they truly understood the idea.
Hello.
Huh? How about you take the break, though? Because she wants to sell some beer, right? And I need one. Why don't we take 10 minutes, come back, and we'll go through another session now.
The other voice you heard was General Paul Van Riper, Brigadier General Paul Van Riper, who was the CG of McCidic at the time, as Zinni discusses the fact that he needed a beer. All right, so,
yeah.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Next thing I'd like to talk about is,
This is after the break, and there's a beer sitting in front of him. It's awesome.
Control a little bit, and I think this is where we get maybe into the biggest trouble. The commander, I tell my headquarters company guys, get them out. That they're really critical. That my ability to command is directly dependent upon their ability to perform their mission, and the confidence the guys that support us, everybody else, and it's. It's key. I think I spend more time on this particular subject, command and control, than anything else. I try to make it a very dynamic thing. My headquarters commandant, my three, my commo, have constantly got to be innovating. They constantly have to come up with new things or new ideas, or I get pissed at them. And they are. Forever screwing around with the SOP, with the facilities, with the procedures, always seeking to streamline them, make them more effective, everything else. And we learn from every CPX, every MAP exercise, everything we do. In 2 years, I told you we deployed or went on a major exercise 10 times. We went on 20 CPXs, probably did about 30 MAP exercises. Every week, I require my headquarters company to do what I call command post training. And it's to make sure that they really keep these things unlimbered. The first thing you have to do as a commander is to create the right environment. Now, you see, I got this philosophy that we like garrisons. Garrisons closely simulate where we're from, back in East Cupcake. So we're used to lights and showers. We're used to racks with linen and all these things. The abnormal thing is the field. We go there, but we don't like it. I mean, we say we do because we're Marines, but we try to gut it out. We don't do wrong things in the field. I mean, I got guys who go to the field to pride themselves that they don't take a crap in the time they're out there. You know, I mean, you got to make them do that kind of stuff. I mean, they change their whole routine when they go to the field. They're not used to it. The environment's got to be one of being expeditionary, of being light, of being active, of being oriented and comfortable in the environment out there. The environment you create has to be one like that. My office in the 9th Marine didn't have shit in it. There wasn't a plaque on the wall. There wasn't a goddamn plant in there or any other crap. I mean, the only good thing there for is to carry your helmet. But I don't, if you have one, you shouldn't have one. You know, but I don't like that. You know, I just got a desk. I got a rule that I don't put anything in the drawers of a desk. But then it's like you want to stay there. So I don't read anything. I will go General Caulfield now. As a steel regiment, I didn't read anything, just sign it. Matter of fact, I took 2 weeks leave before I come over here back in 9th Marine, and I was going after change of command, and a sergeant major came up to me and he said, "Sir, you got to talk to this new guy." He says, "Remember how you sign everything, even a blank piece of paper, if we put it in front of you? This guy reads the stuff now." And then I felt kind of bad about it. But I just signed it. If it's screwed up, I'll kill you. You know, as a rule. They understand that. I mean, that's trust. It's part of maneuver warfare. You know? That's trust. You give me the right thing, I said. I don't spend any time in the office. You get the hell out. Now, how does this relate to command and control? You create the idea that you're going to go to the field, that you want to be in the field, and they're going to be like the field. I destroyed, put away, hid. There is not a cot in the 9th Marine Regiment. No one is ever allowed to sleep on a cot. Matter of fact, General Van Riper was the Chief of Staff, 3rd Marine Division. No one in the division was allowed to have a cot, ever, anywhere. There are no cots. I don't have a tent. I have never slept under a tent in 2 years in the 9th Marine Division. I sleep underneath my vehicle. I sleep if we're foot mobile CP mode on the deck next to PFC so-and-so, you know. Get crap in the cat hole next to the PFC and shoot the shit literally about the weather. You know, that's the way your life has got to be as a regimental commander. I grew up in a Marine Corps, it wasn't like that. Tent City. I mean, if you went to a regimental CP, you wanted to call Barnum and Bailey in to be able to tell him that maybe you could move this with your elephant train. And battalions were just as bad. Thank God we're changing all that. You've got to be light. And where you pay for streamlining and going light are in these creature comfort items. I got a rule. We displace at a minimum every 24 hours. I never spend the same night the same place unless I can help it. I've spent 2 nights in some places, not because I wanted to, because I got forced into it. But I like to get the hell out and to move and not spend any time than I have to. Mobility is security for command and control facilities. You've got to move. That's critical. And you've got to pay the price in streamlining in these creature comforts so you can afford to put it into other things that are more important on the battlefields. You can't go so austere that you can't do the job. And you can't forget, if you're a regiment or a battalion, speaking from that perspective, that you don't go to war as a regiment or a battalion. You go to war as a reinforced regiment or an RLT. Other people come. See, I've seen regiments that say, "This is the COC. We developed it on the parade deck, and it's got all my guys." And I go in and I say, "When you get lag, or when you get engineers, or when you get, you know, other attachments, direct support, where do they go?" "Oh, out there somewhere in the dark." You know, they're never integrated into the system. It can't be that way. Now, how you set up the facility is important. I got to tell you a little bit about it. Now, I want to go back to the sensing of the battlefield, the way I got to do it. My eyes, if they're not on the fight physically, I'm forward. It got to be on the S2's map. Now, my S2 is the key man in my organization. First of all, there's no such thing as an Alpha and Bravo command group below the division level. That's bullshit. You know, you can't do it. You don't have the gear of the people. You can do it for a week and fake it, just like you don't have to take the crap for a week and you don't fake it. But you can't exist in two mirror image CTs. I don't give a shit who you are. You can't do it, not in the long term. You have a CT. You can take the command group out of that CT temporarily, and you can go forward with it. You can operate. You can control with it. But that's different from two mirror image CTs. I operate with a command group that generally stays out forward. I come in occasionally for a lot of different reasons. Change over radio operators, give people a break, get briefed up. I might pass control back on my way or whatever. You know, I might take it and move out. But there's this constant flow in and out of the command group from that CT. My sensing of everything has to be eyes on the two map. My hearing is the tactics, higher and lower. Nothing else do I want to hear. Nothing else is allowed to be on a speaker if anything's on a speaker. But I listen to the two necks. You know, that's what I want to hear. My fire support coordinator, my ALO, quietly come up and mention that there are calls to fire, or there are things to be arbitrated, at least at my level. When I was battalion commander, it might have been calls to fire at my level, that he may pick up on calls for fire, or he may pick up on things that two units need some sort of arbitration on. But he's informing me from that point of view. The intel officer tells me of things that are happening that he's picking up, because he has a lot of eyes and ears out there. I described that one thing we did in the force on force with the LAI battalion, bouncing off one and then going deep. I never talked to the LAI battalion directly through that whole thing. One time after the deception, he swung by my CT on the way out. I never doubted where he was or what he was doing. Without talking to him, we had communication. First of all, he's a good friend of mine. I know him. We think alike. And I knew what he was up to. How did I know where he was and what he was doing? Recon teams reported him. You know, I actually had recon teams out that saw him and reported him, which they were supposed to do. I had pre-planned logistics support that was taken out to him by helicopter aviation drops. They reported. You know, I had other things that flew over, airstrikes and things that went on, that reported his sight. That's a form of communications. Knowledge is a form of communications for what he's doing. We have the rule of critical comm. I used to call it desperate comm, but I didn't like it because it sounded too heavy. So it's critical comm. And critical communication means I only need to talk to you if it's something that affects the intent. Something means that I want to change the intent. You can't accomplish or carry out my intent. The enemy, the terrain, or something else is going to do something to affect the intent. Then we need to talk. How we get to talk? Million and one different ways. And we can figure it out. When I was a battalion commander, I controlled all pyrotechnics that went into the air. They all meant something. Company commanders could have the shit that goes on the ground. But I control the meaning of everything that went into the air. Form of communication. It had meaning. I'm in the attack. I've secured the objective. You know, so by a series of pyro, one company could understand what another's doing. I'm a believer not in vertical communications, but in lateral communications. I want two battalion commanders to talk to each other through an attack rather than me directing them through an attack and they're coming up and I'm going down. Coming up and going down. See, battalion commanders come to me and say, okay, now I know you got so-and-so on the right and left. What do you want me to do? What do you want him to do? Go talk to him. Decide what you want to do. You know, you guys talk it out. I'm going to talk a little bit about control measures in a little bit and how I handle that, how it kind of works in this context too. But they've got to work it out. Do the lateral communications. I'll monitor, listen, or whatever. I'm not worried about it. I don't need to talk to you. We have these bullshit reports you got to get rid of. Somebody comes up and tells you, you got a battalion in the attack. Boom, he makes contact with a squad. You know, he takes a couple of casualties, calls in a medevac, he kills a couple of guys. I get a report saying, I made contact and killed three guys. Well, no shit. That's what you were supposed to do. Why do I need a report? Why do I need position reports? During the force on force, there was a point in time, and I mentioned this to some of you, when I leaned over to my tree, or he leaned over to me, and we were studying the two map intently. Because we were trying to figure out where Fourth Marines was and how he was lining up. We were, and I hate to use this term, we were sort of templating it, you know? Because you know why? ITP works against us. We're so predictable. So I was ITPing him because I knew how he was going to operate. He was falling into place. You know, so I was doing my own intelligence preparation. We had gotten one battalion, we had gotten a CC, and we were getting the other battalion. It was starting to fall in. It was midnight. Lieutenant Colonel John Rosemore, my three, turned to me and says, "You know what, Colonel? Right now," and Glenn Preston, with my fire support coordinator, who was here, was there next to me. He says, "No, right now, we know more about the exact position of the enemy than we do of our own position." And we kind of all chuckled, you know, around Glenn's coffee pot and said, "That's right." Then we tried to figure out if that was wrong. That's got to be wrong. That's unbelievable. We know more about the enemy than ourselves. So we talked about that for a while. We said, "That's okay. We're not doing, I don't need to know where everybody is. They're doing their thing. They're happy. They're going for it. I know where the bad guys are. I mean, life's good. Don't worry. Be happy." And we decided on that. And it was okay. So you have to really structure your command and control and your sensing all these things to pick that all up. I generally like to stay away from, it's not benign neglect, but I, you know, let's say, My mobile CP mode is four vehicles. And sometimes more if you have security and other things. But we're pretty light. We got a way we back them all up, throw canvas over like everybody else does. And we go through the drills to make it speedy. But I kind of try to stay away from that, the internal part there. I go in and check on it, and I go forward a lot and do a lot of other things. But I tend not to get in there and insert myself on top of the watch officer and on top of the three and the two. My three really knew me. He knew when I needed to be there, and he called me in. And he knew when, what to tell me. But I'll tell you what, you can get too close to the problem. You can get too involved, too caught up in the day-to-day and the minute-to-minute. You can get so wrapped into the COC that you burn yourself out. I have an obligation to keep myself fresh, and I do that. I stay out, and I rest, and I cat nap, and I screw off. So when they need to dust me off, we call my friends the El Cid syndrome. I keep telling them that really I'm dead. If they do it, they dress me up in the armor, and they braid me out if it's necessary. So really, the three and the two of those guys, Glenn ran the regiment, and they would just dust me off. And they would say that, "Go get El Cid, bring him in, dust him off, dress him up, make a decision, we'll put him away again. Bomb him, put him away." You know? But I think that's what the commander's for. And I don't think a commander that kind of runs himself into the deck and gets involved in the nitpicking shit is going to make it. And you can't do that. You know, and that's the kind of the environment that you have to set up. I want to talk a little bit about control methods, organization of the battlefield geometry, which we love. But you see, I was probably a distinguished grad at AWS because I knew how many lines to indent the op order, and I knew how to draw, and I could do the symbolic way before your time, but so you're all right. You know, and matter of fact, the guy was a general that then he made the flag, so maybe we would have reverted back to that process. But, you know, I learned to be a draftsman, you know, really a perfect guy at how to draw the battlefield. I drew the battlefield. I actually began to believe at one time in my life that the battlefield really was the graphics that I drew. People believe that now. Show me a main attack. What does the guy show you? He shows you this. There's the objective, there's the axis of advance, and they give them a zone of action, you know, and that's the main attack. A graphic portrayal is some shit. It doesn't mean anything to you. I hate control measures. Control measures are weaknesses. Every control measure you put down is a self-imposed weakness. A boundary is a weakness. A boundary is a scene. When you put a boundary down, you put a scene down. I learned from the VC, the guys try to probe for your boundaries, find them, and attack along them. Why? Because we stay away from boundaries. If you get close to this fucker, you got to coordinate with that son of a bitch next to you. I don't want to have to do that. Stay away a little bit. Where do we put them? Known terrain features, recognizable terrain features, streams, roads, inclusive or exclusive, if you've been to basic school and you can add that term, you know, bridge lines, and these are our boundaries. We begin the box, and we create scenes, stitches, attack the scene. I think the Israeli 73 war, right, between the 2nd and 3rd Egyptian armies, found the boundary, big gap, blew right through, you know, north of the Great Bitter Lake. obscene. I don't use boundaries. Now, I got to tell you the honest truth. The little suckers slip them in on me. They don't think I know it. Right, Glenn? I mean, I know the battalion commanders get all nervous, and they create a bound. They have an agreement between each other. And they'll tell the fire support coordinator so he won't kill them. But, you know, I don't like it. And they always say to me, sir, how can you operate without a boundary? It's got to have a boundary. I say boundary causes vertical thinking. Boundaries mean, okay, because the colonel threw a line, my right flank is secure. So now think forward and talk to the colonel and go. But don't talk to the other battalion or the other company. There's no need because there's a boundary. Hoping that the guy out there on the other team understands that rule that we've just established by the Marcus of Queensburg. Don't screw with me, I've got a boundary here. I'm protected. You know what happens when you have no boundary? They got to talk to each other. They hate it. They got to cooperate, coordinate. And they don't like it. And I love it because it's less work for me. Now it's the lateral communication under this vertical shit up and down. So I don't like boundaries. I don't like too many fire support control measures either. I got something I want to offer all you school presidents, deans, and whatever you are. When you get the new class in, one of your test questions, now we have two types of fire support control measures. Permissive and restrictive, right? Did I say that right? You already counted. All right. Now, let's take one of those permissive summons, coordinated fire line, right? CFL. We all know, because we're graduates here, that that's a permissive measure, that means you don't have to coordinate the shit if you shoot, you know, surface indirect fires beyond it, right? Ask all the new guys what a coordinated fire line is. You know what they'll tell you in most cases? A coordinated fire line is something you have out there that if you shoot short of it, you got to call the guy up and coordinate with him and talk to him. In other words, they put it in restrictive terms. Same with the fire support control measure. They put it out there to protect themselves. It's another scene. It's another protective measure. It's another thing out there that they put in. Run a MAP exercise with CPX with no boundaries and no fire support control measures. Try it. No objections. Clean maps. I mean, you're going to cause some high anxiety to begin with. But watch what happens after you do it. It's amazing how much communication, cooperation, coordination increases and how effective you become. You know, I defy you to do it. I've done it. They hate it. In the end, they love it. They're proud of it. We did this with no boundaries. A regiment with no boundaries. The last time, five numerals. No boundaries. I know sometimes they stuck it in. They got a little worried, nervous. And the three made a deal, cut a deal with the giant fans. They didn't tell. Don't tell El Cid. Got to fucking down. But I'll buy that. You know, there are times when they're going to force me into that stuff. But try it sometime. Get away from the battlefield geometry. And don't ever, if you're a commander, look at the threes map. It's the world according to Bart. It's not the way it really is. I want to talk about another trap we run into. Phasing. As soon as we get into an operation, it's the first time, the first thing we do. Phase line red, phase line blue, phase line Sally, phase line Mary, you know, all phase line Ohio, we line them up. Phase one, phase two, phase three. Phases of offensive combat. Phases, phases, phases. We phase ourselves to death, they have no meaning. We have some natural phases, day to night, night to death. We change everything. Stand guard, stop. Stand two, stand down. You know, we change names of things at night. I was on a final coordination line at the basic school. It got dark. I was on a probable line of deployment. I'm on the same little piece of terrain on a golf course. You suck to change your name because it got dark. If it gets light, you're going to change it back again. I don't understand. And when it gets dark, we do things differently. Release points, you know, guys, all this shit. We're going through this stuff. And when we change from night to day, we phase. We eat three times a day or two. Basically, I can tell what Americans eat. I'm going to generally eat in the morning or sometimes late in the evening. I'm going to have a third meal be around noon time, right? Now, think about this if you're the enemy. I have phases of offensive combat. Phases lead to expectations. When I describe that sequence I went through at basic school, where I went from the assembly area to the objective. Now, your last corporal in the United States Marine Corps, right there. You have just reached the objective. You have gone into the third phase of offensive combat. When I was a lieutenant, it was base. Movement to contact, attack, consolidation, then exploitation. Now I guess it's attack, right? Preparation for the attack. The attack, consolidation. That's the new order, you guys. It's like sort of like Mount Mobile Combat, the built-up area, fighting in tall buildings. I don't know where to go. We change the name every once in a while to get it up, I guess. But we have a faith. That NYS corporal has got an expectation. What do you think it is once he parks his butt on that hill is the objective and he's pursuing by fire, spray and pray? What do you think the expectation is for that land corporal? The expectation is he ain't going to have to get up and go forward. It's rest time. It's gunny with the chow. It ain't gunny with the chow in real combat. We know the bad guy doesn't give us this baby. It's a trap. You know, the sustainment routine can become a problem. The tactical phasing that I just described can become a problem. It leads to expectations. It leads to predictability. Get away from these phases. What a phase truly is, when you don't have a clear picture as to how to get to the center of gravity, when you don't have a clear picture how to fully carry out your intent, you've expressed it, and you're going to get to it, but it is in your mind, in time and space, a ways away. You've got a clear picture of the immediate. Then you phase. Phase one is my clear picture. In my clear picture, my first time ashore, period, I will get a clear picture of phase two. It's a clearing, evolving picture. I'll give you an example. Let's say I'm going to land. This is a fort down here. I'm going to land up here at this beach, come down, and grab this port. There's some bad guys down here. Now, I'm a pretty good distance away. This bad guy put pressure on this port. His other bad guys are strung out in this direction. I'm landing behind him. And I look at this situation and say, you know, it's this line of communication that's critical. Center of gravity. He can be reinforced, he can withdraw, he wants to maintain that. If I pressure threaten, if in time and space I affect this thing, that's what's going to cause him to take the pressure off this, either move back, or have to face and deal with this. But from up here, at sea, in my little boat, that is way far away. I know what I want to be and what I want to do, but when, and it is now not clear. Phase one might be the establishment of that force beachhead line, getting ashore. Getting on limber, getting out to where I'm balanced and I'm prepared to move south. That's phase one. From that phase one, I can't see this yet. Maybe in the second phase, it will be a better orientation and a movement that will get me in line, that will develop the dispositions of the enemy, that will allow me to begin the movement and the deployment. And then in that final phase, I will realize. See, in time and place, and in the clearing picture, the phasing is really in the mind of the commander and how he sees the evolution toward his intent. It is not a daytime thing, a reporting thing, and that sort of stuff. Phasing becomes an attempt to synchronize, which is not good. You know, it stifles initiative. It pulls back on people that can go, that have momentum. Phasing is restrictive. Even if you say, just report at the phase line. The mental picture is we got to all be along the phase line. You know, and if you don't have communications, what does he do? So phasing is a dangerous thing. It's automatic. It's one of those things that were built in that we got to watch. It doesn't work. You have to create in your organization a sense of mental and physical action. Anytime I see somebody heat up an MRE, I displace the CT. But then I know we've been there too long. Anytime a guy breaks out a heat cap or he dicks with it, you know, he takes this MRE, and he's going to combine them in accordance with the McElhaney little cookbook he had, it's time to move. You know, we've been there too long. We don't do that stuff. And the idea is this agility, the ability to react. I want to follow up with something very, very important, a very important distinction. Tempo is controlling the pace of battle. Decisions like whether to give battle or refuse battle, cause, you know, generate the action, cause reaction, get inside the OODA loop, you be the actor, he has to be the reactor. Dangerous little thing you gotta watch here. Never confuse activity with tempo. Never confuse speed necessarily with tempo. Never confuse the fact that you do more things with you being more relevant on the battlefield. Vietnam's a classic example. The more active force was the U.S. We were more active, we did more things. It was useless activity that expended useless energy. It did not control the tempo. The guy decided what he wanted to fight. An analogy for you. You've all seen boxing matches where the little guy comes out, all high speed geared to go, and for the first five rounds throws 138 punches, the other guy's two, and then, kaboom, he's on the deck, right? He never controlled the tempo. He was more active with a lot of irrelevant activity. Irrelevant activity means doing things for the sake of doing things. We did that in Vietnam. Irrelevant activity means chasing irrelevant vulnerabilities and counting them. The little Gomer in Vietnam was easy to kill. He was easy to kill. We liked that he was easy to kill. Sometimes he wasn't even the bad guy. We just killed somebody. Hey, throw a grenade down, make him a bad guy, you know? And so we counted him. This was fun. To bag these little suckers like dove season with no restrictions, you know? That was a vulnerability in that he was easy to kill. It was an irrelevant vulnerability, and we expended a lot of energy chasing that vulnerability. Get the bodies. Shoot them. I was assigned to dig up graves, smelly graves, and 80 by count them, you know? Got two more for the head. Be fun. You know, that's the way we had to go about the idea of war. Chasing an irrelevant vulnerability at an activity level that meant nothing. Those of us in Vietnam can tell you about endless sweeps that we conducted. Nobody was there except booby traps. We swept. We did it. At the end, you know, remember, you know, they talk about now, good morning, Vietnam, all shit. The radio would come on, the guy would say, U.S. Air destroyed 80 miles of trench line today. Oh, shit, so what? You know, 80 miles of trench line. We destroyed an irrelevant activity. We felt like we were in control because we were doing that shit. And you got to watch that, because that's when your energy level goes down. Maneuver versus firepower. Why versus? Because we have created a mindset, gentlemen, that these two things are in competition. I know you didn't intend to do it, but as soon as you said these two, or the implication was made, or we drew the inference that these are competing, you made them fight each other. As soon as you made the implication that one was subordinate to the other, which is bullshit, firepower is nobody's handmade. I don't give a shit what you say. I like firepower. It kills. It's macho. It's steel on target. You know what's happening out there? I want to tell you. We're teaching our people to kill people with people when they don't have to. I say kill people with things, not people. The lieutenant, the captain, will move against an enemy when he could kill him. Read Rommel. Rommel says, as soon as you get hit, plaster the bastard with fire. First thing you do, plaster him with fire, you know? Fire and movement. Maneuver and firepower are complements. They're meant to be integrated. Don't get hung up. It's the same mind game like deciding on LV and LOV, trying to decide which one's subordinate to the other. There are times when you will kill with firepower. Maneuver will set it up. There are times when you will kill with maneuver and firepower will set it up. We had fire flushes in Vietnam. We laid in a series of ambushes. We blew the shit out of the mangrove trees, flushed the little bad guys out, and then killed them there. Firepower pushed them into the maneuver elements, and we killed them that way. There were times when we led them in to a trap. I shot a 714-round TOT one time on a bunch of bad guys that got sucked in because they found the gap. No shit, you found the gap, Jack. And it was 714 rounds on your ass, you know? Firepower did it. Maneuver faked them out, let them into it. Got to teach these lieutenants how to integrate. I was on a board today where we didn't think about this. Find the hill and knock the guy off. Why? Smoke him and HE him and go around him. Now, again, read about the North Koreans during the first parts of the Korean War when they came down to the Busan perimeter. Look how they handled the army. The army propped itself on every piece of high ground. They just flowed around them. Tank fire, artillery and everything suppressed them, pinned them down, and they just flowed around them, all the way down. Low ground, valuable low ground. Recon versus security. Worst thing I can hear is security screen or recon screen. Recon does not screen. Screening is security. Security orients on the good guys. reconnaissance and intelligence collection, or answer the bad guy. I know people that say, I got my eyes and ears out because I'm surrounded by reconnaissance units, reconnaissance patrols, and sensor strings. Your eyes aren't out. You're secure. You're protected. You're in a hole. None of that shit's oriented on the enemy. It's all oriented on you. I know people that put sensor strings in on their flanks, and then the tube controls them. If I put a sensor string on my flank for security, that's the tree's obligation to worry about that sensor string, not the tubes. That's not intelligence collection. That's security. There's a difference. So, on what you're orienting on. If you're going to go after the bad guy with your intelligence collection, you need to go after the bad guy. If you're going to use those assets for your own security, don't deceive yourself that it's collecting intelligence. It'll tell you when doomsday's coming, that's for sure. You've been penetrated, and he's coming pretty fast, but don't confuse these two. I teach a class on all this shit, and on how to saturate areas with intelligence collection assets. I get a lot of questions from lieutenants like, sir, if you have to do a route reconnaissance, if you have to clear a road, how do you do it? If you have to go into an area, like a jungle area, something like that, you're not sure where the enemy is, how do you seek them out? What's your pattern? I teach checkerboarding, crisscrossing, cross-train patrolling, all those sorts of things that are means of taking an area, dissecting it, picking it up, and finding out what's in there. You know, and it's a whole set of techniques to be picked up, part of the battlefield skills. In the security part of this thing, you need to protect your own vulnerabilities, your own centers of gravity, your own lines, your own resources. I want to talk a little bit about the reserve. We designate a reserve. I don't like the term reserve, since we're into changing terms. Reserve is like in cooking. Reserve to a...
Alright. That'll stop there. He's awesome. Coming up here, he talks about General Erskine. I should scan some of his documents I have and put them up on our website, but... I have the oral history that he's talking about with General Erskine, and pretty interesting. I need to get Charlie Niemeyer on, who just retired from the Marine Corps Historical Division. To me, all that stuff. I mean, Why we don't have access to it on the Marine Corps Historical, you know, their digital archives and all that, I don't really understand. Grace B. Erskine's oral history, and that's what Zinni read, and that's a talk about the night attack. They did. Japanese totally no idea they were there. Americans didn't do that. Yeah, and the guy goes to the wrong hill. Then they tell him, and he's like, oh, shit, and he goes to the right hill. But again, the reason we're going to do this is there's a discussion in the Marine Corps whether the Marine Corps got too far away from the intellectual pursuit of its craft. And I had a number of people call me and say, hey, why don't you, you were kind of there when this stuff happened. Why don't you have people on? So we're trying to do that. Damien O'Connell, who's back at in Quantico working, he's trying to assist, and hopefully General Gray will come on, and we'll talk to him about the intellectual part of when he was Commandant of the Marine Corps and the life he blew into this, and then bring other people on, like Ben Reipers, get generals who need to talk only about this. And command and control and how it's changed. Because I would tell you that it's even more problematic now because you have the means to watch, down to the company level. Is that a good thing? And it's not. They're their own sovereign command down there, right? Part of a unit, but they've got a full up brown staff and they're fully capable. And the last thing they need is other people sticking their nose into their business while they're trying to execute. And you would not believe the number of people that do that. I could tell you stories about during Fallujah, the number of people that would be in a chat room that weren't anywhere near the division or involved in the fight. And some of them would actually speak, right? Hop on the net. It's like, whoa, stop. Anyway, interesting stuff. Zane tells this funny story here at some point. Tells two really funny stories. And probably tells 100 in this thing. But one is about recon battalion on Iwo Jima. He says they did rear area security. He said, what the hell else are you going to do with them? Put them out 1 meter in front of your position? And really funny. And they talked about a lieutenant. They're doing an exercise in Germany. And he says, they catch all this German armor. Their scouts tell them, every German tank in the world is in a clearing up here. And so they're putting together they're going to run vehicles up, tows and whatnot, tanks, tows, everything they got, take it on in the assembly area. He says, the tow platoon commander says, sir, I have to tell you, tow is not an offensive weapon. And he gives him the doctrinal, like, and Sidney looks at him like, are you shitting me? Shut up and get out of here. But anyway, don't touch that dial. This program repeats itself momentarily. Pretty interesting. Again, you can go to the website if you want to watch the video. But again, the reason we're doing this is somebody said, hey, Mac, you really should do that and with commentary. So there you have it. All right. Don't touch that dial. This program repeats itself on a Wednesday. Have a great day. All Marine Radio. And tomorrow, Bo Higgins joins us. Marine officer, got out as colonel, intel guy, lot of experience in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, and now working for Amazon. So we'll talk about transitions tomorrow as we continue. Happy Valentine's Day to everybody. And if you're a Catholic, go get your ashes.